Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Hippocrates, almost 2,500 years ago, made reference to kidney stones in the Hippocratic Oath. He said, "I will not cut persons laboring under the stone, but will leave this to be done by men who are practitioners of this work." Today, kidney stones occur in about 1 in 10 Americans and are thought to becoming more common. Bladder cancer is the fourth most common cancer in men, but a little less common in women. Our phone numbers today are 550-8422 in Anchorage. Our outside number, 1-800-478-8255. Our email address, line1@aprn.org. Coming up next hour, we'll be discussing kidney stones, bladder cancer, and answering your questions.
Today's program is underwritten in part by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. Providence, Alaska combines state-of-the-art technology with a team of skilled and experienced physicians and nurses. With locations in Anchorage, Wasilla, Seward, Valdez, and Kodiak, Providence offers needed medical care close to home. For more information, log on to providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence, Alaska Medical Center.
Welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Today's topic are kidney stones and bladder cancer. Our phone numbers are familiar to you if you listen to APRN's Talk of Alaska. In Anchorage, you can call us at 550-8422. Our toll-free number, 1-800-478-8255. And our email address, line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, at aprn.org. My guest today is Anchorage urologist Dr. Wes Turner. Before we get started, I just want to mention next week's guest will be Judith Bendersky. I'm sorry, she's head of the Alaska's Medicare Information Office, and Robin Schmidt, who's a public affairs specialist with Social Security Administration in the state of Alaska, will be addressing your questions and hopefully solving some questions about myths on Medicare. Dr. Wes Turner is a urologist, as I said. He's been here since 1994, and in 1997, he started Alpine Urology, did all of his urology training at the University of Iowa, and he's a diplomat of the American Board of Urology. This is his first visit to Line One. Welcome to Line One.
Thanks, Dan.
Well, Wes, it's just great to have you here. I'd like to start with the basics. Tell us a little bit about why mammals have kidneys in the first place. Why do we have a urinary tract?
Well, higher mammals have the kidneys to produce waste, excretion of breakdown products in the blood, primarily urea and ammonium. That's the primary function and the one that is responsible for the kidney stone formation. Additionally, there are other functions of the kidneys, such as regulating electrolyte balance, sodium and potassium, as well as acid-base balance, checking the pH in the body. Okay. They also make a hormone that's responsible for controlling blood pressure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's something that even myself, I don't stop and think about all the time. I think of it as a great big filter that helps get rid of some of the byproducts of metabolism, but it is important for keeping sodium and potassium and blood pressure and, as you said, our pH balance in good arrays. And so without the kidneys, we would not be able to survive.
That is correct. And that's why they have renal doctors
have
that
dialysis machines, yeah, that do that for us, which is kind of neat in its own right. But all right, so it's always a difficult question to ask guests to kind of paint us a picture of the urinary tract system or any anatomic system. But tell us the big parts of it. So as we talk about bladder cancer and kidney stones, we have some idea what's going on.
Sure. Well, if you come over here to this board, I can show you. No, I'm just kidding. So 25%, every time the heart beats, 25% of the blood goes down the large vessel called the aorta from the heart, and 25% of that goes into the kidneys. The blood then ultimately ends up in a small little place called the glomerulus. The glomerulus is a filter. I liken that to a screen on a window. Then if you keep the mosquitoes and flies and hopefully no seums out, then you're nice inside. Mm-hmm. So the kidneys do, in a simple way, that's how I think of it. The glomerulus is a screen. It filters the blood at that point. And there are more complex parts of the kidney that control and regulate, much like a thermostat in your house would control blood pressure and the sodium and potassium through passive and active mechanisms. there's a vein, obviously, that drains after the blood comes in. It drains out. The waste products go up from smaller channels to larger channels, ultimately forming drops of urine and many recesses of the kidney, and it forms what's called a collecting system. So if you think of a kidney, and if anyone's, you know, butchered an animal or otherwise looked at a kidney, the solid part of it is where the blood actually flows through. But buried in the middle of that is what we call the renal collecting system. Renal means kidney. And that's where the urine collects. Mm-hmm. From there, it goes down a tube called the ureter, not to be confused with urethra. From the ureter, the urine drains down this long tube, which is maybe varies in length from 20 to 26 centimeters, depending on how tall one is, down into the bladder. And the function of the bladder then is to store urine and also to expel urine. So mm-hmm. from there, it comes out the urethra, not to be confused with the ureter, mm-hmm. and it exits the body. Okay. It's a complex system. In a male, there's a prostate just below the bladder that gets a lot of press.
Yep.
But that's essentially the simple anatomy of the kidney.
The bladder not only is a storage organ for urine that's coming down from the kidneys and the ureters into the bladder, it's also a muscle. So when it contracts, you then void. Do the ureters themselves have muscles, or how does urine flow? Is it propelled down, or is it mainly gravity?
No, there is a propulsion mechanism. There's mm-hmm. a layer of muscle around the ureters. Mm-hmm. So there's an inner lining, which is similar to the lining of the inside of the bladder, mm-hmm. and that's made of a certain type of cell called a transitional cell. Mm-hmm. And there is a layer of muscle around that. So much the same as when we eat, it's not necessarily gravity that pulls the food down, but it's a peristalsis, mm-hmm. the body's natural autonomic or automatic way of mm-hmm. propelling food down the esophagus, urine down the ureter.
Mm-hmm. I do a lot of work with respiratory problems, and I explain to my patients that the inside of our respiratory tract is covered with mucous membranes, and the skin, the outside of our body is covered with skin. Skin makes scabs. The mucous membranes make mucus. The gastrointestinal tract will also make mucus, and I am not as good about saying that that's true of the genital urinary tract, but I think of that as also a specialized mucous membrane. Is that fair to say? I mean, is that too much of an oversimplification?
Per se, it doesn't secrete.
Mm-hmm.
Its function is to keep the urine from coming in contact with any of the muscle there, typically.
Okay.
So it's not a secretory
okay.
system.
All right. Anything else about the anatomy? I'm going to ask about hematuria or blood in the urine and where that comes from, but I want to make sure we've touched base on the important anatomical considerations here.
Well, it's out of the scope of what we're talking about today, but there's also a sphincter
uh-huh.
that holds the urine in because
right.
the way I outlined it is
yeah.
what a bird would have. You know, you never know when that thing's flying over your car.
All right, so we can control it better.
Yes.
Theoretically.
Yes. And we see some problems with that
okay.
from time to time.
All right. So the outlet between the bladder and the urethra has a muscle control that's in voluntary control for the most part. We can control releasing that and letting it release in the dam, so to speak, or not.
Yes.
If the nerves, and we want to do that, if the nerves are intact.
Okay. That's right.
All right, so one common denominator, if we talk about bladder cancer and kidney stones, seems to me to be hematuria, which is the medical term for blood in the urine. So one of the first things I might ask is, where does that blood come from? Why is there blood associated with anything in the kidney? So, and how does it get there?
The kidney normally will excrete some blood in the urine, but there's a standard of more than 3 red blood cells per every high-power field when one looks at it under a microscope that's considered abnormal. There are two ways to check for hematuria, and this is a message that I wanted to why I wanted to speak on this today. There's a way to just use simply a chemical dipstick, which is a peroxidase-induced reaction, lyses red blood cells, and then we'll show the presence of hemoglobin from a red blood cell. That's a chemical reaction. There are negative. If that's negative, there's probably no blood in the urine, but they're false positives as well. The definition of hematuria, at least a microscopic amount of hematuria, one that you can't see with your naked eye, is that you should look at it, or one trained professional should look at it under a microscope to determine whether or not there's truly blood there. Mm-hmm. There are some, if someone urinates, there's two types of blood. There's gross hematuria and microscopic. Gross or macroscopic blood means that you urinate and you see blood there, and normally the response is, oh my gosh, there's blood there. There's something really wrong. Mm-hmm. There could be blood if you have red urine, or there could be other reasons for that. And it's important to have a urinalysis done to determine whether or not that's blood or could be something else.
So gross bleeding may give you kind of coke-colored urine or bright red. Could be enough blood that it really looks like blood. There's more blood than there is urine at times.
It would appear that.
Yeah. And breakdown products of the hemoglobin, you said, may give it a more of a coke-colored urine at times. And then microscopic, you may not even know that there's any blood in there. But under a microscope or with some of these tests that are available, we could detect that.
Yes.
All right. And is, you said a little bit of blood is always normal, but abnormal amounts indicate something wrong, and a little bit of blood or some bleeding is not necessarily indicative of anything serious. Could we maybe just talk about common reasons that are not very important, since we're going to talk about some more important reasons here in a second that may cause some bleeding?
You know, in children, over one-third of the time when blood is noted, it's usually a benign cause. But that's because they're children and they haven't smoked and worked in industry, mm-hmm. and haven't been exposed to potential carcinogens that adults have. Mm-hmm. So for children, oftentimes it's benign. The majority of the time it is benign, but still there needs to be a workup performed. In adults, the risk of bladder cancer and stones goes up with age. So you would ask about the benign causes, or mm-hmm. benign meaning those that aren't cancer. A urinary tract infection would be probably the number one cause, as well as kidney stones perhaps, or maybe they coexist. But other symptoms would go along with a urinary tract infection in most cases. If someone had a typical cystitis or bladder infection, as it's known, they would have oftentimes what we call dysuria, meaning painful urination. They also would have frequency of urination, basically something that irritates the bladder that makes them know something isn't right, and that might be accompanied by hematuria, either gross, probably microscopic. Mm-hmm. If one had a kidney infection called pyelonephritis, they would have flank pain, usually, and fevers, a more severe type of infection.
Mm-hmm. Let me take just a second also to remind our listeners, you're listening to Line 1, and if our topic today is kidney stones and bladder cancer. We've not gotten there yet. We're talking briefly about hematuria or blood in the urine and what that might mean, since it does have a common factor in both of those disorders. My guest is Dr. Wes Turner, a urologist here in Anchorage. If you've got questions or comments about what you hear today or some experiences you've had and want to ask some questions, let me give you a couple of ways to get a hold of us. Our local number, 550-8422. Our toll-free number, 1-800-478-8255. And our email address is line1@aprn.org. You can reach us through any of those ways till just before 3 o'clock today. You can also hear the program again at 8 o'clock tonight, 8 to 9. And as you, those of you who follow us regularly, you can always go to our website and look at past or listen to past programs as well. So the presence of blood in the urine is helpful. It may not be obvious to people if it's small amounts. Symptoms are helpful in helping us as physicians to determine the cause and so forth. My father went in for back surgery and had a screening urinalysis at the Cleveland Clinic and had some red blood cells and was subsequently found to have bladder cancer. And I suspect that's not an uncommon way. He had no other symptoms as far as I was aware of. So is that a common presentation for bladder cancer, is a little bleeding and maybe no pain, nothing else?
That is not uncommon.
Mm-hmm. How common is bladder cancer? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, you stole my thunder in the beginning of the show. You said it was the fourth most common.
Oh, geez.
So I'm done here.
Well, I heard it's only the ninth most common in women. So
that's true. Eighth or ninth. Yeah, so it is the fourth most common.
Okay.
Prostate cancer is the most common, followed by lung, colorectal cancer, and then bladder cancer.
So it's a relatively important thing to be thinking about.
It is. Interestingly, as I was preparing for this show, believe it or not, I came across something that said that at autopsy, they have rarely found bladder cancer at autopsy, which would indicate that bladder cancer usually reveals itself during the course of our life. So much like your father. And, you know, I think it can't be overstated that once a year, at least for an adult, you should see a primary care provider, have a urinalysis done and part of the general physical exam. And, you know, maybe one year you don't have blood in your urine, maybe the next year you do. Mm-hmm. I might take a moment to add that a common scenario that I see for women is after their menopause ceases, their postmenopausal or perimenopausal, if they've had serial urines, that is urines done every single year, after their menopause ceases, they may have a little bit of blood in the urine. And despite doing a workup for that, which we're going to talk about later, I think, mm-hmm. I ascribe that to the lack of estrogen on the urethra. Because it's in the same location, it's just a tidbit of information.
Okay.
So it's not always bladder cancer if someone comes in with blood in the urine.
Mm-hmm. Are there different kinds of bladder cancer, and are there particular ages that are more risk or individuals who may have greater risks?
Yes, definitely. It's 5 the risk of bladder cancer goes up with age and also in smokers. Mm-hmm. There's a fourfold increase in bladder cancer in smokers than non.
Mm-hmm.
The bladder cancer can occur in children, although it is very uncommon. And usually if it does, it's highly treatable mm-hmm. with a simple resection. But as one ages and potentially longer exposure to potential carcinogens, it goes up. There are certain occupations, including being a physician, that increases your risk of bladder cancer, too.
Hmm.
People that work with aniline dyes, which were introduced in the 1800s to dye textiles, mm-hmm. have increased risk of bladder cancer. People, metal workers, machine workers, people that work in the rubber industry with petroleums. I'm not talking about working at a gas station, but putting your hands in those things.
Mm-hmm.
Mechanics and hairdressers that may use permanent dyes all have increased risk of bladder cancer.
I know my father was a smoker, and that was the first time I had learned that was, as I remember, that was the principal risk factor. I mean, he certainly was not in an aniline dye or anything. And I guess it's chemicals that are getting cleaned out of the bloodstream, to make it fairly simple to think about, that get sit in the bladder for a while, is thought to be the reason for that, or is there other mechanisms that might happen?
That is probably the simplest way to think of it. Mm-hmm. There's some change with DNA mm-hmm. at the cellular level, but I think of it that way. And certainly there have been some studies, I can't quote the study, but those who have more dilute urine, the potential carcinogens are not going to sit in the bladder quite as long, and you're going to expel them.
Okay.
And it would be more dilute.
I'm going to go ahead. We have a phone call. It looks like this may be more about prostate, but I don't want him to hang on, and I think you can handle the prostate questions as well. Rick, you're on line one.
Hi, thanks for the call, and you thanks bet. For your time on the air, Doc.
You bet.
My question is about what I what I am presuming to call benign prostate issue, and that being, you know, reduced urine flow, et cetera, et cetera. And I do some saw palmetto on occasion. I don't have any kind of real problems with stopping, et cetera. You know, I feel like it's fairly mellow at this point, but, you know, I'm in my mid-50s, and I'm wondering if there's I try to reduce my or not have a lot of medical intake, you know, medicine intake. I'm interested in meds that are fairly easy to take and don't have a lot of side effects. I'm wondering if anything that you could recommend other than the saw palmetto as a fairly benign med to help with those symptoms.
Well, that's a very good question. The herbal medication saw palmetto comes from the bark of a tree. I believe it's the palmetto tree that's been used for at least 20, 25 years, maybe even longer, and sold over the counter. It was thought for a long time to provide relief for symptomatic benign prostatic hypertrophy or difficulty that males have as we age of emptying our bladders. For a long time, well, actually, I still would recommend if you think it works, if you take it, sort of a single trial, take it for a month and see if it improves your symptoms and stop taking it for a month and see if it doesn't. You can do your own experiment. There was a study finally done by the American Urological Association, or at least published in a journal, that compared saw palmetto to placebo, and there was no significant difference between the two. Other than that, there are no over-the-counter medications, to my knowledge, that are available that would be of help.
And as far as script meds that are out there, are there meds that stand out as the least troublesome in terms of side effects?
That's another good question. There are two general classes of medications for BPH, the difficulty you're describing.
Mm-hmm.
One blocks a hormone that is responsible for the conversion of testosterone to a more potent form called dihydrotestosterone, which occurs in the prostate. And those drugs are called Proscar or finasteride and Avodart or dutasteride. They will, because it's a hormonal change, it takes probably in one case 2 months and another about 6 months for them to be to notice any effect. So more commonly what we do is we start with what's called a selective alpha blocker, and there are a lot of nerves to the sympathetic system at the bladder, neck, and prostate. So the prostate isn't just fixed. Like you can imagine, you know, if you're standing on a hose and the water is going through it and you're standing on it, oh, if I get off of it, it's going to go faster. There's actually a tone to the prostate, and there's a lattice work of muscles that go through there that are innervated by alpha sympathetic nerves. There's a wire going into it from the nervous system, and that particular wire is called an alpha wire, if you think about it that way. And those selective blockers will block or relax the tone of the prostate or the tone of the squeeze against the urethra and allow you to void better. Sure, if you've watched a football game, you've seen multiple advertisements for these things because we're the kind of guys that watch those things. Flomax is common. Uroxetrol is another one. And there's another new one out that I don't have much experience with called Rapaflow. Those will typically work within a week or two if you try them.
Okay. Side effects?
If I may, can I ask one more question?
Sure.
I don't know if it's still being practiced or if it's increased in the use, but the TUMPT procedure as a way to reduce prostate pressure, is that still ongoing and growing in use? Or?
Yeah, it's still available. There are other ways to treat it as well. Typically, I'm conservative, so I would rather take a medication because if you have a side effect from medication, you can stop the medication and the side effect will likely go away. If you have a surgical procedure and you have a side effect, you can't undo that
microwave.
undo that side effect.
Yeah. Great. Well, listen, I really appreciate your time and thanks for being there and answering questions for us.
Sure. Thanks for your call, Rick.
Thank you.
How about side effects? Again, we're off the subject a little bit, but are there? What are the most significant or most common side effects with these medications that are used?
For the, I discussed two classes. One, well, I'll start with the second one since I think it's more commonly in use. The alpha blockers, and I was talking about selective alpha blockers. Alpha blockers are also used for blood pressure, in the form of the brand names are Cardura, or Doxazosin, Hytrin. Hypotension, that is, if you arise from a sitting position or a lying position, the normal response of the body is the alpha nerves will cause constriction of the blood vessels and perfuse your brain. They get a little sluggish with some of these alpha blockers. That's why they came up with selective alpha blockers, which work on a subunit that is predominant in the urinary tract, especially at the prostate and bladder neck. So that's one. The most common side effect is what we call orthostatic hypotension, dizziness upon standing in lay terms. Other ones are fatigue. Those are really the most two most common.
Okay.
And with the second class that I had spoken of, Avodart and Proscar, that shrink the prostate, the side effects from those are usually not much, but it's a decrease in volume with ejaculation, and also some men get breast enlargement.
I always like, when we talk about medications, to think about this in some real logical way. And the way I've tried to promote on this program, because I think it does make a lot of sense, and when I talk to patients, is when you think about side effects of medication, the real question is what's the side effect, what's the risk if I don't take a treatment versus the risk of the treatment. There is no risk-free treatment. You're never gonna find one. You can drink so much water that you can get sick. So you always have got to balance those risks. And so for a patient like Rick, perhaps it's how much discomfort, how much problem, how much it's interfering with his life. And then the other issue that's important is if we know a medication or a treatment is ineffective and that all treatments potentially have side effects, it really makes very little sense to continue something that we know doesn't work.
I would agree.
And we're beginning to get more and more of that information. Sometimes it's confusing for the public, but I think it's those are very important principles. Physicians hopefully are trying to live up with those ideas, but the patients need to be thinking about them as well. We're going to take a short break. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection in Anchorage. You can reach us at 550-8422. Our toll-free number is 1-800-478-8255. Email us at line1@aprn.org. After this break, we'll continue to take your calls and emails if you'd like and discuss urology with Dr. Wes Turner on Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Line 1, Your Health Connection, comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from the Lake Otis Pharmacy, prescriptions, support hose, medical equipment, and a full selection of satellites in Alaska. The Lake Otis Pharmacy on Lake Otis, one block north of Tudor, with the wheelchair on the sign. And by Providence Imaging Center, offering innovative ways to reduce anxiety surrounding annual and baseline mammograms with mammogram parties. Information at provimaging.com.
Listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Today, my guest is Anchorage urologist Dr. Wes Turner. So email your questions and comments to us at line1@aprn.org. You can give us a call at 550-8422. Our outside toll-free number, or outside Anchorage toll-free number, is 1-800-478-8255. And You got to remember, if you're listening between 8 and 9 on KSKA, you're listening to a taped rebroadcast, and we won't be available. We've been discussing bladder cancer up to this point. We hope to spend some time talking about kidney stones at this point of this program. But before we do that, I'm going to ask Dr. Turner to talk to us a little bit about treatment of bladder cancer, and then we'll move on. So what are the options, and what's the typical way that we would handle bladder cancers?
If I could back up for just a moment, Thad, bladder cancer comes in varying stages and severities and grades. The most common is a superficial bladder cancer. So if you think of a balloon, and the balloon itself is the lining of the bladder, and if you imagine a complicated balloon with a layer around that, that would represent the muscle. That's what the bladder looks like. So the majority of those tumors, if they arise in the superficial lining, the inside lining, they can usually be managed cystoscopically, that is, by a urologist looking into the bladder and using a small resection loop to shave them off. The second, those are treated if oftentimes you treat them one time, cut them out, and then we have to do surveillance. So that requires checking about every 3 months for a year, every 6 months after that for up to 5 years to make sure there's no recurrence. Those kind of tumors are like weeds in the garden. They can pop back up again. Mm-hmm. If they've shown a propensity to reoccur, they may progress. And we use what are called intravesical. Vesicle refers to the bladder. Intravesical therapies, and depending on what type of tumor it is, we can either use chemotherapy or immunotherapy, which involves putting a catheter in the bladder and once a week putting medication in there for 6 weeks. And there are different regimens, but this can go on for a long time. And in the course of those treatments, at three-month intervals, we always like to take a look and see that it's been effective.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And this is a highly curable cancer, particularly when it's found relatively early.
Yes, it is, with the caveat that it can recur, and fortunately it doesn't progress often.
If it's found late or not addressed, that's when things get more difficult. I remember just, as you said, looking into this for the program, I remember something like 90-95% of these have a 5-year survival rate. So it's a pretty good cancer as far as cure. If you say 5-year survival is a cure, then this is a highly curable kind of cancer.
Yes, yes, especially if it's caught early.
Mm-hmm.
The ones that still, I don't think I'll ever get over it. This is a cancer I really don't like.
Yeah.
I don't like any of them, but this one, you know, some patient can show up the first time with blood in the urine, they've done everything right, and they have a muscle invasive tumor.
Uh-huh.
And if I could discuss that for a second, the treatment for a muscle invasive cancer is different.
Uh-huh.
There are several layers of muscle. If it's a super, what I discussed earlier was called a TA. That's a staging called, the T stands for tumor, and A is a superficial tumor. There can be a T1 tumor that invades just a superficial layer of muscle just underneath that lining. And you can manage those much the same way. The pathologist, that is the person who looks at the specimen once we remove it from the bladder, will also grade the cells to see how aggressive the tumor looks, whether you know you're dealing with a small engine or a big engine, one that has a lot of oomph to it that's going to cause some big problems. And if it's a higher grade tumor in a T1 or if it invades the deep muscle, the best treatment option is either removal of part of the bladder or more often the entire bladder, which then leaves you with the situation where you need to divert the urine somewhere.
Mm-hmm. So I guess the lesson is we want to move on to kidney stones is that I'm hearing is the older you get, the more you have painless hematuria or hematuria with some other symptoms. These are things that really ought to be looked at fairly quickly and be sure we get it right, the diagnosis made. Is that a good point to leave everybody with?
That is correct. And if if you have blood near urine and you get treated with an antibiotic, you better make sure you follow up and make sure that blood really truly went away and was related to the infection. If you don't have symptoms, you better make sure you have a urinalysis done again and then get the appropriate referrals.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, so we're going to move on to kidney stones. What's a kidney stone?
A kidney stone is a solid concretion or calculus that forms in the kidney.
Okay.
And typically we think of – or the average person would think of a kidney stone because they knew someone who had a kidney stone that had the worst pain of their life.
Right.
But a kidney stone can exist without causing any pain. And the way it's discovered is in the workup for microscopic hematuria or someone that may have recurring urinary tract infections without – pain in their kidneys, but this acts as a source of recurring infections. Mm-hmm. So a stone is normally the urinary tract carries a liquid called urine, and that forms up in the kidneys. And if the urine gets super saturated, it forms a stone. I think of it when I was in Cub Scouts, I made rock candy. So I supersaturated the water with sugar, I think mm-hmm. it was,
yep.
and heated it up. And then as it was cooling down, I stuck a string into it. And then it was amazing how fast all of that salt came out of solution onto that string. That's essentially what happens with a kidney stone. It's a supersaturation of the urine with whatever the chemical is or the salt that's involved with making the stone.
So we're all at risk. 1 in 10 of us, according to my statistics, have them. Some people seem to have more than others, but basically it's a salting out of certain chemicals within the urine and under lots of different processes. And you get variable sizes and shapes, and some are painful and some are not.
That's true.
All right. Let's see. We have a couple of phone calls waiting and a couple of emails now. So let me go ahead and take a couple of those and see where it takes us. Jenny, you're on line one.
Hi, I was calling because I wanted to know if there was any sort of link between frequent bladder infections and bladder cancer, or if there were other long-term sort of effects of frequent bladder infections. And then secondly, if there are any supplements that help promote healthy urinary tracts. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thanks for your call.
No problem.
So basically, what's the consequences of frequent urinary tract infections, and particularly, is there anything that is it related to cancer? And then, I suspect if you're having lots of urinary tract infections, or what else can you do to help the urinary system to be healthy?
With recurring urinary tract infections, we would recommend looking for a source for the urinary tract
and
infections.
Why is that happening?
Yep. It could be post intercourse. That's not uncommon. And if we can say that's the reason for it, then oftentimes either we or your family physician may treat you with postcoital antibiotics.
Mm-hmm.
When I see a patient with recurring urinary tract infections, meaning they've had more than one a year or two a year, depending on their age, and certainly in a male, only one, then I would embark on looking for a cause, such as a kidney stone. And oftentimes we use a upper urinary tract. The upper urinary tract would be the ureters and the kidneys to image and rule out a stone, for example, an anatomical abnormality depending on your age. Mm-hmm. For children, we do a study to rule out reflux, that is urine that may go backwards up the ureters and then come to rest in the bladder and be associated with recurring infections. You'd ask an interesting question about whether or not the presence of infection is related to bladder cancer. In the presence of a foreign body, it can be. And the people that would have a foreign body in their urinary tract would be those with a spinal cord injury, for example, or progressive multiple sclerosis, some reason for example, not having a neurogenic bladder, not having a normally functioning bladder, and they would have a catheter left in their bladder long term. And they are at risk for bladder cancer. It's typically a different type than the typical bladder cancer, 90% of which are transitional cells. And, these are like more often squamous cell cancers. But in general, in the absence of a foreign body in your urinary tract infections are not associated with increased risk of bladder cancer.
How about a question about bladder health? My first thought is drink a lot of liquids.
I would agree with that.
Okay. There's not any magic chemical. I mean, we hear about cranberry juice as mm-hmm. preventing infections and so forth. Is that real or not so real?
If it's Ocean Spray.
And that's because you own Ocean Spray stock.
No, I know someone who does.
Oh, okay.
No, right. No, seriously, the study was done by Ocean Spray.
Oh, okay.
And it applied, I believe, it's been a long time since I've read that, but it was published, and there was a decreased incidence in urinary tract infection. I believe it was in hospitalized elderly women.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a
so that's
distinct
where that came
subset.
From, but yeah, we don't know if other cranberry juice, and we don't know if just taking more liquids, was it control for other liquids? And like
right.
I've got a, yeah. And while we're on the topic, I might as well ask. I got an email before in the program that asked about a gentleman who said he knows a friend, and both he and the friend have a lot of bladder stones or kidney stones, and this gentleman's father had tremendous amount of stones until someone told him he should drink a beer every day, and after he drank a beer, wouldn't you know it, no more bladder stones until he eventually died. You know, any reason to think that a beer a day is good or bad for preventing stones?
The only reason I could think of would be the fluid involved, but there have been no reports to my knowledge that drinking a beer a day would decrease the incidence of stone formation.
Well, let's talk briefly. I understand that hydration is a very important thing. So taking lots of liquids is probably one of the most important parts of prevention of kidney stones. However, beer is a little bit of a diuretic and may dehydrate you over time. So I would perhaps argue, if I had that test question, that it would not be a good idea. What you think? Neither one of us are experts on beer and prevention,
no.
But I can argue that I don't know that I think that's the greatest idea in the world.
I would go along with your argument.
Okay. But hydration is a very important part of all of us, maybe at increased risk during periods where we're getting more and more dehydrated constantly. So taking some source of liquid is preventative to most of us.
Indeed. And the recommendation that I have for my patients is to drink between 2 and 2.5 liters of water a day, mm-hmm. more if you were physically active or in a mm-hmm. hot environment, to produce at least 2 liters of urine output a day.
Okay. All right, Richard, you're on line one.
Good afternoon. I'm interested in finding out, please, about dietary what kind of diet I can have to prevent further kidney stones. I've had about a half a dozen attacks over the past 15 years. The last one was about 3 weeks ago, and you're right, it was extremely painful. So what can I eat to keep these attacks at bay?
Okay. So this gets to the question in my mind, and you tell me, Richard, if this is getting too far, is that there are different kinds of stones, and so that based on the kind of stone, there may be supplemental suggestions for treatment or prevention.
I passed the stone about 15 years ago, had it analyzed, and the analysis is someplace where I can't find it.
Okay. Okay.
So it's either one or the other, right?
Richard, was the stone visible on a plain X-ray? You know, just
No, I actually passed it and saw it.
Okay, but before you have you ever had an X-ray that?
No, I haven't.
Okay, Thad brings up a good point. It's more complicated than what some people would lead you to believe. That well, drink more water. That's true for any type of stones.
Okay.
There are essentially 5 different kinds of stones. The most common one is a calcium oxalate stone. A calcium oxalate stone one could see if you had the equivalent of a chest X-ray, but of your abdomen. Although it contains calcium, which is in dairy products, and oxalate, which is in rhubarb, which is a really popular food, I think, and beets and things like that, and teas and colas and chocolate, it isn't so simple as to say, well, just cut those things out. And an example of that would be that if you cut out calcium from your diet or decreased it as much as you could, you'd leave a lot of free oxalate in your gut. Oxalate itself is 15 times more potent in forming a stone than calcium. And in fact, what one would want to do if you had a calcium oxalate stone and you were known to have hyperoxaluria, meaning a lot of oxalate in your urine, you would want to take calcium supplements to try to bind the oxalate in your stomach or in your intestine to inactivate it so it comes out in your stool instead of coming into your urinary tract and forming a stone. So I can simplify this for you, because if we knew the type of stone you had, then one could design a program for you, hopefully, to decrease your incidence of stone. The number one way to decrease it is increase your fluid intake to 2 to 2.5 liters a day of fluid, such as water, Gatorade, or something like that, not 2.5 liters of beer, as Dr. Woodard had recommended.
No, I didn't recommend.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Can it be determined what kind of a stone I have by through urine analysis?
Partially. One type of stone called a uric acid stone forms in acidic urine and will precipitate out in acidic urine, meaning it forms a stone there. If you alkalinize the urine or were to take sodium bicarbonate, you would tend to dissolve that stone. So uric acid stone, even if you had one, it may be possible to dissolve that, and you wouldn't necessarily need any treatment. It sounds like you've had recurring stones.
I've had about 6 onsets over the past 20 years. The last one was murder.
Yeah. So if you have the stone, it could be analyzed, and that would be a good starting point.
Yeah.
Has anyone ever talked?
I'll try to catch one.
Has anyone ever talked to you about having some just chemical analysis on your urine and blood, and to see what whether you are handling certain products effectively, and they may get some hints about that even without having to have a stone?
Not exactly. First time I had it, long time ago, I went to a doctor, and the recommendation was to go to a urologist and have some kind of monstrously expensive treatment to dissolve the stones with, I think, lasers or tasers or masers or something.
Mm-hmm. I don't think it would be inappropriate to see a family practice physician, a urologist, or a nephrologist, and I'm going to ask Wes to tell me if I'm wrong. I don't want to give bad information. If you've had a lot of stones, or if I had a lot of stones, I'd be wanting to know why am I having more, and I think relatively inexpensively, you might get some information by just some simple biochemical tests on blood and urine that would help you. And lots of different physicians could do that, and you don't have to go through a lot of pain and discomfort to get that answer.
Sure, okay? That's great. All right, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
You bet, Richard.
Bye.
I got a similar email, Wes, from a woman who says her daughter, 24, has kidney stones about every 6 to 8 months for 4 years. She says she's usually very well hydrated, doesn't take any vitamins. You may want to comment on that comment. But she does ask a question that I'm not sure, and maybe she's saying this wrong. She says she does appear to have something called Randall's plaques. She has a question mark, visible in imaging. Can she do anything? So we've talked about some of the strategies with Richard, who just called, but what do vitamins have anything to do with kidney stones? And do you know what she's referring to as Randall's plaques, or does she have the word wrong and we're not going to help her?
She is correct.
Okay.
That was a very good question. The Randall's plaque is the beginning of a kidney stone at almost a microscopic level. Well, probably not a microscopic level, since they were seen likely on a CAT scan. Mm-hmm. But we didn't go into the microscopic anatomy of the kidney. Mm-hmm. But when I talked about the blood flowing into the kidney, eventually going through the glomerulus, mm-hmm. there's loops in there as well. The loop of Henle, which we're familiar with, and it ultimately ends up in the collecting duct. If in the collecting duct there are is where Randall's plaques form. They're precipitations of usually calcium oxalate, and then they can pop off. I liken it to what's also known as medullary sponge kidney, which isn't diagnosed quite as often anymore because we don't use what's called an intravenous pyelogram, but we typically use computerized tomography or CTs to diagnose stones.
So basically, the Randall's plaque is a very early abnormality in the collecting system of the kidney that seems to be a predisposition for stones. We don't know that they'll go ahead and have stones, but someone who's having this many stones and this, it suggests that's something's wrong with how she's handling these chemicals.
With the anatomy, probably.
Oh, with the anatomy.
So it may be medullary sponge kidney, and she's at an increased risk of having stones and urinary tract infections.
Okay.
And then it's very important, as you alluded to in that last caller, maybe do a 24-hour urine collection, rule out hyperparathyroidism with a blood test, and see if there's a way to prevent these from forming.
So our advice to this listener would be see a urologist or nephrologist again, or someone who's specializing in this, and bring that information together that there may be some important things that can be done to prevent it.
Anyone who has that many stones, it'd be nice to prevent them.
Yeah. How about the vitamin association?
Things come in waves, like circumcision versus no circumcision in your field.
I was going to ask that if we had time, Larry. Okay. Never mind.
So I think anything in moderation is reasonable.
Okay. Yeah.
And also, once again, it depends on the pH. If you have a uric acid stone, please don't take vitamins C and acidify your urine, because you're going to make it worse.
Yeah.
So it really is as simple. It's more complex than what you're told. If you ask some little old lady in South Carolina or Mississippi what you should do about your stones, and they'll tell you don't drink iced tea. Well, that really probably won't affect it too much. But you need to be scientific about the formation of stones, and that takes a blood sample and a urine sample. And that caller was right. I mean, I think that test is fairly expensive, the 24-hour urine collection, to see what is abnormal about how your kidneys are handling different substances.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much. Got one more caller. Let me also just mention to our listeners again, if you've got questions or comments, let me tell you how to get a hold of us. 550-8422 is our local number. Toll-free number 1-800-478-8255. And our email address, line1@aprn.org. All right, Peter, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yes. Back in the late 50s, which tells you something, I was a nurse on a genitourinary surgical unit, and we got a steady stream of patients through with papilloma of the bladder, for which we did diathermy, which is one. Is that still a very common thing to happen? Because I don't hear about it much up here. And secondly, when people had a complete bladder resection, we did an ileal loop bladder. And we're just wondering if that procedure is still done or if there is a better technique these days.
Right. Peter, were you a nurse on a nursing unit, if that's what you were applying, in the United States or another country?
No, in North London.
Oh, in North London. Okay, because sometimes there's slight differences in how things are handled. But
I understand.
Okay, great question.
A papilloma is a grade zero. If we grade them, it's a grade zero transitional cell tumor. And they're benign. And if we saw one, it's essentially a polyp. If you equate it to what one sees in colonoscopy, it'd be a hyperplastic polyp, I suppose. Something that's benign, it's not going to turn into a cancer. And yes, we would use diathermy just to bug be those or to just treat it.
The other question was about ileal loops for bladder cancer and removing and that. Look, I'll let you go ahead. I'm a little familiar with some of that stuff because I went through this with my dad, who had to have more done than just a little bit.
Yes. Back to bladder cancer, and we had talked about the treatable ones that we look in and resect them, and people preserve their bladders. The case of diversion, if the bladder's removed, one has to form some new sort of reservoir and emptying mechanism for the urine. And the oldest treatment, well, one of the older treatments was actually called a ureterosigmoidostomy, where the ureters were plugged into the sigmoid colon, but that was associated by mixing urine and stool with an increased risk of cancer in the colon. So that was abandoned before I ever started practice. And the ileal conduit you speak of is still in use today. It's has its place for the appropriate patient. A younger patient, say in their 50s, is active and doesn't want to have a bag on their abdominal wall, for whatever reason, may choose not to have an ileal conduit. That is the simplest surgical solution to bladder cancer and its diversion. Now we can use what's called a neobladder, and that's done by different configurations of using small intestine and a bit more ileal conduit or ileal segment than what you saw with ileal conduit, which is about 15 centimeters. We probably use about 30 to 40 centimeters and fashion that into a sphere, detubularizing the segment, and it's placed onto the urethra. In order to do that, one must make sure that the cancer doesn't extend into the urethra, however. But that works very well, and you have to be motivated to have that type of procedure done. One must be ready to catheterize themselves. And ultimately, people that have had this done, both men and women, get a sensation that their bladder is full, their neobladder, and they can often void to completion so that long-term they don't necessarily need to use a catheter.
Okay.
Sounds like a much better procedure. Thank you very much.
Yeah, great
Thanks
question,
for your call.
Peter. Thanks. Tony, you're on line one, and you might have a question here that's always interesting to me because I've never heard of this. What's your question?
Well, I've been diagnosed for years with something called Gilbert's syndrome. Oh. I basically have elevated bilirubin.
Yeah, Gilbert's syndrome. Okay, I understand that
Gilbert's,
one.
Gilbert's, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And I was always told that it was completely kind of, not to worry about it, that it was completely innocuous. But I read something recently that said people who have it might be more prone to getting kidney stones.
Okay. Dr. Turner,
I'm not familiar with
shaking
that.
Shaking his head, and I'm shaking my head. I don't know that for sure either. There's something called Crigler-Najjar and Gilbert's. They're two disorders of the liver, and there may be some effect on the kidney, and you're asking the wrong guy. I don't know the specific. That primarily they're causes of jaundice that are otherwise not noted, and my understanding is most of them are not really having any pathologic reasons. But whatever the reason for Gilbert's may have something to do with excretion of chemicals in the kidney. The bladder or the kidney may use the same enzymes and so forth. So I can envision that there might be some connection, but neither of us are aware of that.
Okay, thanks. Well, I'll have to do some more research.
Yeah, get on the internet and put Gilbert's in there and put Gilbert's in stones and see what you come up with.
Okay, we'll do that.
All right, sorry we couldn't be any better help. It's already close. We got just about 40 or 50 seconds left is all. I was going to ask you about treatment a little bit. Maybe I have less time than I thought. I'm hearing that music. Sorry. All right. We didn't get to treatment, so we'll have to try to do this again.
I'd enjoy that.
All right, I've had a good time as well, and we want to hear more about what to do about stones. We'll return next week, and my guests will be discussing Medicaid or Medicare, and we'll be more than happy to address all your questions at that time. I want to remind everybody that Pat Yak is Vice President of APTI News and Public Media. Kristen Spack generously engineered today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400. Stroke is an emergency. Providence, Alaska Medical Center is committed to increasing awareness of the symptoms of stroke. If you or anyone you know has sudden weakness on one side of your body, sudden confusion, trouble speaking or understanding, sudden trouble seeing, walking, or loss of balance, or sudden severe headaches without cause, call 911 and get to the hospital within 1 hour. Information at providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence, Alaska Medical Center.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.